this is Monocle Reads. I'm Georgina Godwin. And my guest today is Russell Jones, a sensory consultant. He's fascinated by how our senses change how we feel, think and act every day. And he's determined to share this insight with the rest of us. His book, The Power of Your Senses, details his sensory prescriptions from waking up to going to bed and everything that happens in between. He wants these to help readers to live more multi-sensorially and ultimately better. Russell, thanks so much for coming in.
Hello, Georgie. Thank you.
Explain your job. It's quite difficult to...
It's quite difficult to explain. I can't do the old elevator pitch 30-second thing of it, I'm afraid. It's, sensory consultant. I mean, everything is based in an area of neuroscience called cross-modal neuroscience, which shows us how all of our senses are completely intertwined and intermingled, that music playing in the background will change the taste of something, that the shape of a glass will change the taste of something, that when you see a bottle on a shelf, if it's got colours and images towards the bottom of it, say for a bottle of shampoo, you will believe it's more efficacious because it looks heavier. So it's the way we translate things through one sense into like an assessment of something through another sense. And so as a job, I do this with brands from everyone from retail stores to luxury cars to bottles of shampoo, and consult on how they can design involving every single sense, to think about every single sense when they design something, from using colour and packaging to add sort of perceived weight, to changing the sound of an indicator in a car or the sound of a bottle cap when you close it, to communicate craft and authenticity and, you know, strength and power and quality. So it's about paying attention to every single nuanced interaction that you have with something and engaging every single sense in a congruent way to enhance, essentially, make it a better product, make people's enjoyment of it better.
How did you come to this? Because it's not the sort of thing, you know, when we're 5 years old, we want to be a fireman or something.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I wanted to be a sound designer for cinema and write music for film. And I did write music for years. I used to make sort of instrumental beatsy, Giles Petersy sort of stuff in the 90s, and was doing kind of sound design for films and short films and stuff. I was working with a choreographer doing sound and sort of movement. And I've always been fascinated with the effect that sound has on us and how it affects us emotionally, that sort of cinematic effect that sound and music really have. And also the fact that you don't notice it. You know, we're very visually focused. If you go into a film, you really kind of, most people don't come out going, the sound was amazing. But the sound absolutely makes the emotional, like, can change the emotional resonance of it. Anyway, that's always been my fascination. And having written music for a while, and never realizing I'll never make millions with the type of music I make quite sort of underground niche music, I just had to have another application for it. So I started just doing more sound for in installations, in experiences, and using that idea of that cinematic emotive power of sound in a space. And then after a little while, for brands, I started doing sort of sound branding. And it wasn't until, I'm an absolute glutton when it comes to food and drink, and I'm interested, like I said, in the way sound affects our experiences. And I actually sent an email to Heston Blumenthal about 15 years ago or so, just saying, I love what you're doing and I'm really interested in how sound can affect experience and can it affect taste. I went down there to the Fat Duck and ended up hanging around with this guy called Jockey, James Petrie, who was the head of the developmental kitchen or experimental kitchen at that point. And we just started playing around with sound and taste. The upshot of that was this dish called Sound of the Sea, which you put on headphones and you get served sashimi and you listen to waves crashing. And it was proven up at a lab at Professor Charles Spence's lab in Oxford that the sound of waves crashing there, it was done with oysters, actually totally enhanced the taste of the oysters, your enjoyment of it, made them taste fresher. Your people sitting in a booth eating oysters, listening to waves crashing. They'd done this study. So anyway, that opened me up to this amazing world. Sound doesn't just affect your emotions, it can affect your sense of taste. And that just... From that point on, I started reading all the neuroscience, doing studies, taking ideas for studies up to Oxford, and it just grew from there and into this multi-sensory offer and fascination and love for me.
I mean, the book is fascinating, and you've worked with some extraordinary partners, but also on some very odd projects.
Yeah, I have. That's what's been lovely about the agency in my work is it can be completely within absolutely anything. We're doing different things all the time. We're sometimes doing, we did an immersive cinema for Lagavulin Whiskey that toured around and went to China. We've, you know, worked on John Lewis's sort of retail store. We've worked on Aston Martin's indicators. We do everything because it does apply to absolutely everything. And this is why the point of the book, you know, we do it in work, but also it applies to absolutely every aspect of our lives. It's about paying attention to all these nuanced elements of your sensory environment can completely change your behaviour and your perception for the better in the way we live, as well as, yeah, through design.
So. Well, let's go through it, because the book actually does take you through a day living really to the sensory max, I suppose.
Yeah.
So what should, I don't want to use the word, what should we be feeling, but what should we notice when we wake up? How do we enhance that process?
Waking up. Okay. I have to memorise my entire book from start to finish now, which is fine. It's a good test. So, well, waking up is the first thing about waking up, which is quite interesting, is our standard form of being awoken by this kind of Wagnerian loud alarm. Meh, meh, meh. It's just the worst possible idea. And I don't know who came up with that. You know, we're born with one or two sort of innate fears, and one of them is the fear of loud noises. So why you'd want to bring that up to the first thing in the morning, I do not know. But we are, I mean, a lot of things I talk about in the book is about our circadian rhythm and how we're, and every single being and microbe on the planet is in sync with the sort of natural order of night and day. And we're very much should be in that, in sync with that. And the best way to wake up is with light. And there's been studies where they get people to sleep out in the Rockies in Colorado who have had really bad sleep problems, sleep inertia when they get up and they're tired or can't go to sleep, terrible, terrible sleep. And they just correct after a couple of days, just being out in the under the natural light. So light is this natural way of setting our circadian rhythm for the day. So we should be waking up with light, not sound. And I know you can get these alarm clocks that do this kind of artificial dawn, and they are absolutely proven to wake you up in a much more beneficial way.
Mm.
And then you can use sound, and I talk about using sound, but it should be gentler. And maybe my idea is to link that with this natural order and just have the kind of gentle crescendo of birdsong and activity just suddenly slowly arising in sync with the light, and that's a lot much more gentle way to get you up.
Now, once we're up, of course, we've got to get dressed.
Yes.
Tell us about enclothed cognition.
Enclothed cognition is the way in which we will behave and even think in a way that's in keeping with the meaning that we associate with items that we wear. So studies have shown categorically, for instance, if you wear a lab coat, you're better at maths and logical reasoning. And when they've given people a lab coat in these studies and said, this is an artist's smock, then they don't behave as well. So it's only when you're associating that absolute meaning to it. And this is actually kind of poignant at the moment with everyone from remote working going back to work. And, you know, I've been working in my pants for 6 months and can't I do that in the office? And the point is, well, no, you shouldn't. I mean, but it isn't about what you shouldn't just wear the, you know, standard boring office outfit. Wear things that are appropriate for what it is you're going to do. If you're wanting to be creative, wear something that is loose and free-flowing. You will genuinely think in a more loose and free-flowing way. If you need to be, you know, very business-like and you've got tough, intense negotiations happening that day, then go for the 80s power look, because it will make you think in that way.
What about perfume?
Yeah, perfume and smell is, again, really, really important. And I think it's an interesting thing, because men definitely, I would have thought, think a lot less about scent than women. But it's such an important thing to use and to wear. I mean, for one, it's all the studies show that we behave in a more confident way. We exhibit less nervous body language when we ourselves smell better. And other people will see you as more confident, even if they can't sort of smell you and they're seeing you on camera or something. They will see you as a much more confident and dynamic person when you yourself smell better. But again, you can use different smells to influence your behaviour. You know, you'll behave more active and sort of zesty and full of life if you're wearing a zesty and fresh aroma. Also, research shows that a lemon scent in a room makes you view other people as more attractive.
And I've also read that if you smell of grapefruit, you appear younger. Is that
really
true?
Well, that one didn't come up in my research, but maybe. Well, I mean, well, grapefruit is a fresh, zesty, citrusy aroma, and that's a very uplifting, stimulating scent, so I wouldn't see why. Yeah. It's exactly that point. And this is throughout the book. those kind of emotional connotations or effects of something will then directly affect not only your own emotions, but then your perception. So things will taste more zesty. Mm. The world will seem brighter. You know, colours will seem brighter. Those sensory sort of effects translate across senses and across perception.
Is there a scent that can lower your stress levels?
Well, again, all senses, and ideally combining all of them together. If you want to create an environment that is the most calming, you want every sense to be congruent. But arguably, you could say aroma may be the strongest, most powerful one to do that. Although, again, light and colour and things are all going to play an important point. But, you know, what we all consider or know as those calming scents like lavender or things, they are 100% proven, measuring sort of lowering respiratory rate, lowering heart rate, lowering anxiety levels, you know, both sort of measured on EEG and sort of self-reported. Mm. So, yeah, they do have a very physically calming effect. But yeah, it's about that combination. I mean, it's been shown that touching wood lowers your heart rate and lowers your stress levels. There's this guy in Japan did this amazing studies, and he's had people just putting their hands on different materials underneath a blanket so they can't see what they are and measuring respiratory rate and heart rate. And touching stainless steel actually caused a spike in stress levels, and touching wood lowered it. And it's to do with a kind of natural connection, he argues, that we have, you know, with anything natural that is intrinsically calming.
Let's get back to our day.
Sorry, yeah.
When you're having your morning coffee, I've just served you some coffee, which is in a white cup. I apologise, because apparently if it's in a red cup, it tastes better.
Yes. Well, I mean, it tastes better if you want something to taste sort of fuller and richer and potentially a little bit sweeter. Yeah, we have an evolutionary, completely inbuilt link between the colour red and things tasting sweeter. Now, this may be linked to potentially as hunter-gatherers, we would have learnt that fruit on the trees would have been a deeper colour red when it was more nutritious. And so it's more beneficial to pick it and wait until that point. And so maybe that's been kind of ingrained in us. Mm. But yeah, red's a very interesting colour because it can have different connotations depending on the context. But in the context of taste, we've completely shown that, yeah, something in a red cup on a red plate or drinking it in a red room will make it taste richer, fuller, sweeter, more pleasurable generally. Mm. Exactly the same coffee, if you pour it into different coloured mugs, will taste different.
How extraordinary. Now, I often ask writers on this programme if they can write to music, if they need silence or if they need music. Some really interesting replies over the years. Elif Shafak, for instance, the Turkish writer, writes to heavy metal, which I find extraordinary. Other people can write to music, but they can't have any lyrics because it will be distracting. Tell us about music. And you've talked a little bit about how it changes how you feel about things. I mean, for instance, the minute I hear anything in a minor key, I want to weep.
Yeah, absolutely. That's amazing why that sounds intrinsically sad. It's fascinating how we get that sort of emotional communication through music so strongly. Music as a background to kind of work, productivity, creativity, it is a contentious issue because there have been loads of studies done with varying results about, you know, with music with lyrics, music with no lyrics, music with foreign lyrics, so there's words but you don't understand them, and has productivity increased, and generally no music. Well, the most beneficial background has been shown is just a sort of gentle sort of hubbub of activity and noise, like a cafe soundscape. And I do say this a lot with work. People always think about putting on music, but very rarely would they think about putting on a sound. Mm. And actually putting on a soundscape, there's this kind of state of mind of positive distraction that's really beneficial for kind of focus and getting in a state of flow and creativity. And that kind of non-repetitive blanket of sound where nothing jumps out, nothing's jarring, that sits in the background and so slightly takes a little bit of your sort of cognitive attention away, but not much. That's the perfect background. Now, to achieve that in music, the point really is for it to be something you like that's familiar, because if it's unfamiliar, it takes too much cognitive load to kind of concentrate on it. So if it's just something you like and it's upbeat and you're being productive, then absolutely fine. And absolutely crazy, mental, noisy music like metal, I completely understand, because, yeah, if you know it and you like it, then you will get lost in it to a point. But also it will just sort of sit in the background and just sort of give you that energy that's in the background.
In the book, The Power of Your Senses, you give us a sensory prescription for productivity, focus and attention to detail.
Yes. Well, so I guess the first point is that my sensory prescriptions, this is, again, what I do with work, and it's translating that over, is when you look at what's the outcome you want? What's the sort of, in a work side, it's what's the sort of consumer outtake from this product, or what do we want to communicate from a brand point of view? In this, it's what do we want our behaviour or our perception to be? And then we use the science to then define the right colour, the right smell, the right material, the right textures, the right shapes, the right lighting, all these different things that will then line up and be congruent to help you get in that state, because congruency is the point.
Is that going to be the same for everyone, or does it change for different individuals?
Well, the majority of this research shows that there is a universal kind of inbuilt evolutionary or sort of maybe learnt effect to these things. So they should be universal, but obviously they are a starting point because personal taste has to come into it. Because you can't just sit in an environment that you really dislike. That's not going to have any sort of positive effect on you. So personal taste, cultural variation does play a part, but a lot of what we're talking about, this neuropsychology, this cross-modal associations and cross-modal correspondences between each sense seem to be very just universal and human.
So what do I need to do for max productivity?
Well, here we see another connotation of red. Red is a stimulating colour, you know, and it has these, again, evolutionary links to kind of fight or flight. Scientists have shown that people make less mistakes if they're typing in a red room. Interestingly, you make the most mistakes in a white room. And you're more vigilant because of this kind of fight or flight sort of response it causes. It makes you focus and have more attention to detail and more vigilant. So you want a red object around you. Now, you don't have to sit in a red room because that actually would be quite oppressive. You don't want to be that high. But I suggest having a different coloured notepad for different types of work. So for your productivity kind of focus work, maybe you've got a red notepad. And that's going to give you that little stimulation. So you want that red colour. You want to pair that with then a stimulating scent. There was some research in Tokyo in an office, and they had the scent of lemon in, I think, and that increased workload and productivity by up to 50%. But there was another brilliant study where people chewing different chewing gums is a way to deliver the aroma. And when people were chewing cinnamon chewing gum, they were more productive with task-orientated, sort of focused work. Cinnamon sensorily goes with the colour red. So if you think of what colour is the smell of cinnamon, most people would say it's red. And actually, I mean, itself is a sort of reddish-brown colour. And this is about the building up the congruence. So you've got cinnamon, which is a red scent. So make yourself a cinnamon tea or have a cinnamon bun or spritz some cinnamon scent in the air. Have your red notebook in front of you. Put on your sort of cafe hubbub in the background or some music that you like, that you know well, that preferably has no lyrics and that is quite upbeat. And we start sort of building this kind of sensory prescription. And then you can bring in an item that's going to give you material priming in the same way enclosed cognition will change your thinking. If you're being very productive and you've got a calculator or a ruler in front of you, it will cue up those kind of that type of thinking in your mind. Or maybe your red notepad is a red Filofax if you're getting all very business-like. So this is all for very kind of cognitive, detailed tasks that you need to do. That sort of early in the morning at work when you need to tick things off and do things that don't require particular sort of moments of inspiration.
What about if, for instance, I mean, at the other end of the day, you're relaxing and all the rest of it, but if you wanted to create the atmosphere, say, for a perfect social gathering, what would that entail?
Okay, well, it depends on the social gathering. I mean, that's the point, is that you should be choosing music that goes with what you're drinking. You should be choosing music and lighting and everything that goes with what you're eating or what the sort of, atmosphere is. So if you've, say, got friends over for dinner and you're serving white wine, then you should be playing Blondie, because it's been proven that Blondie makes white wine taste 25% more zingy and uplifting. And don't put on sort of big dramatic classical music, because that will completely ruin the wine. Do that if you're drinking a Malbec, or put on some Serge Gainsbourg or something. I would if you've got a red wine on the go. So, pair the music with the taste of what you're serving. It will taste better and it goes. And this is all about, this is the point. Now, think about these things. Don't just arbitrarily put on something that has nothing to do with what you're serving if you're handing over. You know, I mean, generally down to the point that if you're cooking food from a certain sort of nationality or certain cuisine, then put music on that's kind of reflective of that, not to the point of being a theme restaurant, but, but you know, something that mirrors it. And create an atmosphere that is conducive and congruent with what you're serving.
You have a fantastic chapter about home and the emotions and functions of each room.
Yeah, that's a really interesting research, because when you look at sort of how we should set up the sensory environments of different rooms, there's a lot of thinking about how you should kind of maintain or keep the sanctity, maintain the sanctity and the purity of the sort of use of an each room. Like a bedroom, for instance, don't just hang around in it and talk about finances. It's for sleep and sex. And if you keep it as that, you will sleep better in it. If you, you know, it hasn't been sort of sullied with these kind of other sort of elements of life. And it's, again, that's a really important thing with working from home that we've kind of got into now, is you're completely ruining the whole sort of, where do you go when you've finished work if you're sitting in the kitchen or sitting in the lounge?
Yeah.
To then have a transition from work to home to relaxation. If you don't have the ability to have different rooms for that, then changing that sensory environment, when you've finished one thing like your work, then light a scented candle or spritz something in the air, put on some different music, change the lighting, switch that sensory environment. It helps you mentally kind of transition.
Yeah, yeah. And finally going to sleep.
Yes. Well, sleep is a fundamental part of life, that there is not a single molecule of your body that does not benefit from a good night's sleep. And again, it's very much to do with our circadian rhythm. And the lead up to sleep is incredibly important, you know, and we are with artificial light since its invention, and even worse now with our screens and our, you know, bright LED screens, we're messing our circadian rhythm up later and later on into the night, just constantly staring at screens and in our lights. So in my book, I talk about this kind of sensory prescription is a 3 hour or so lead up to sleep, where we can sort of slowly remove that lighting and gives ourselves a kind of warm orange glow, which kind of slows us down. How things like writing a journal, they did some really good research with writing journals at the end of the night, either writing what you've just done during that day, like a sort of diary of what you've just achieved, or a list of things that you're going to do tomorrow. Both of them, or people in both of those groups, got better night's sleep than people who didn't do any writing. But the people who got the best night's sleep wrote the list of to-do for the next day, because it feels like you're actually getting those things out of your head, those worries, those plans, you know, those anxieties that might be there for the following day. So writing a little journal of what you've got to do, a list of to-dos or things you're going to do, really, really helps. Reading, even just reading for 8 minutes, has a marked effect on the quality of sleep that you get. So there's a few sort of things that you can do as a routine, and the routine's really important. If you have the same routine every night going leading up to sleep, you will fundamentally sleep better.
Russell, this is absolutely fascinating, and what a great guide of really how to live, how to enhance our lives in every way. The book is called The Power of Your Senses. It's by Russell Jones. It's published by Welbeck, and it is out now, isn't it?
It is, yes.
Yeah,
it's on
fantastic.
On Amazon.
Russell, thank you so much for talking
to me. Thank you so
much. You've been listening to Monocle Reads, thanks to our producer, Nora Hull, and researcher, Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.